Chapter 16. Serpent Sanctuary. From Cholula, we drove east, past the prosperous cities of Puebla, Orizaba, and Cordoba, towards Veracruz and the Gulf of Mexico. We crossed the mist-enshrouded peaks of the Sierra Madre Oriental, where the air was thin and cold, and then descended towards sea level, onto tropical plains, overgrown with lush plantations of palms and bananas. We were heading into the heartlands of Mexico's oldest and most mysterious civilization, that of the so-called Olmecs, whose name meant rubber people. Dating back to the second millennium BC, the Olmecs had ceased to exist 1,500 years before the rise of the Aztec Empire. The Aztecs, however, had preserved haunting traditions concerning them and were even responsible for naming them after the rubber-producing area of Mexico's Gulf Coast, where they were believed to have lived. This area lies between modern Veracruz in the west and Ciudad del Carmen in the east. In it, the Aztecs found a number of ancient ritual objects produced by the Olmecs, and for reasons unknown, they collected these objects and placed them in positions of importance in their own temples. Looking at my map, I could see the blue line of the Coatzacoalcos River running into the Gulf of Mexico, more or less at the midpoint of the legendary Olmec homeland. The oil industry proliferates here now, where rubber trees once flourished, transforming a tropical paradise into something resembling the lowest circle of Dante's Inferno. Since the oil boom of 1973, the town of Coatzacoalcos, once easygoing but not very prosperous, had mushroomed into a transport and refining center with air-conditioned hotels and a population of 500,000. It lay close to the black heart of an industrial wasteland in which virtually everything of archaeological interest that had escaped the depredations of the Spanish at the time of the conquest had been destroyed by the voracious expansion of the oil business. It was therefore no longer possible, on the basis of hard evidence, to confirm or deny the intriguing suggestion that the legend seemed to make, that something of great importance must once have occurred here. I remembered that Coatzacoalcos meant Serpent Sanctuary. It was here, in remote antiquity, that Quetzalcoatl and his companions were said to have landed when they first reached Mexico, arriving from across the sea in vessels with sides that shone like the scales of serpents' skins. And it was from here, too, that Quetzalcoatl was believed to have sailed on his raft of serpents when he left Central America. Serpent Sanctuary, moreover, was beginning to look like the name for the Olmec homeland, which had included not only Coatzacoalcos, but several other sites in areas less blighted by development. First at Tres Zapotes, west of Coatzacoalcos, and then at San Lorenzo and La Venta, south and east of it, numerous pieces of characteristically Olmec sculpture had been unearthed. All were monoliths, carved out of basalt and similarly durable materials. Some took the form of gigantic heads, weighing up to 30 tons. Others were massive stelae engraved with encounter scenes, apparently involving two different races of mankind, neither of them American Indian. Whoever had produced these outstanding works of art had obviously belonged to a refined, well-organized, prosperous, and technologically advanced civilization. The problem was that absolutely nothing remained except the works of art, from which anything could be deduced about the character and origins of that civilization. All that seemed clear was that the Olmecs, the archaeologists were happy to accept the Aztec designation, had materialized in Central America around 1500 BC with their sophisticated culture fully evolved. Santiago Tuxtla. We passed the night at the fishing port of Alvarado and continued our journey east the next day. The road we were following wound in and out of fertile hills and valleys, giving us occasional views of the Gulf of Mexico before turning inland. We passed green meadows filled with flame trees and little villages nestled in grassy hollows. Here and there we saw private gardens, where hulking pigs grubbed amongst piles of domestic refuse. Then we crested the brow of a hill and looked out across a giant vista of fields and forests bound only by the morning haze and the faint outlines of distant mountains. Some miles further on, we dropped into a hollow. At its bottom lay the old colonial town of Santiago Tuxtla. The place was a riot of color. Garish shop fronts, red tile roofs, yellow straw hats, coconut palms, banana trees, kids in bright clothes. Several of the shops and cafes were playing music from loudspeakers. In the Zocalo, the main square, the air was thick with humidity and the fluttering wings and songs of bright-eyed tropical birds. A leafy little park occupied the center of this square, and in the center of the park, like some magic talisman, stood an enormous gray boulder, almost 10 feet tall, carved in the shape of a helmeted African head. Full-lipped and strong-nosed, its eyes serenely closed, and its lower jaw resting squarely on the ground, this head had a somber and patient gravity. Here, then, was the first mystery of the Olmecs, a monumental piece of sculpture, more than 2,000 years old, which portrayed a subject with unmistakable Negroid features. There were, of course, no African blacks in the New World 2,000 years ago, nor did any arrive until the slave trade began, well after the conquest. There is, however, firm paleoanthropological evidence that one of the many different migrations into the Americas during the last Ice Age did consist of peoples of Negroid stock. This migration occurred around 15,000 BC. Known as the Cobata Head, after the estate on which it was found, the huge monolith in the Zocalo was the largest of 16 similar Olmec sculptures so far excavated in Mexico. It was thought to have been carved not long before the time of Christ, and weighed more than 30 tons. Tres Zapotes. From Santiago Tuxtla, we drove 25 kilometers southwest through wild and lush countryside to Tres Zapotes, a substantial late Olmec center believed to have flourished between 500 BC and AD 100. Now reduced to a series of mounds scattered across maize fields, the site had been extensively excavated in 1939-40 by the American archaeologist Matthew Sterling. Historical dogmatists of that period, I remembered, had held tenaciously to the view that the civilization of the Mayas was the oldest in Central America. One could be precise about this, they argued, because the Mayan dot-and-bar calendrical system, which had recently been decoded, made possible accurate dating of huge numbers of ceremonial inscriptions. The earliest date ever found on a Mayan site corresponded to AD 228 of the Christian calendar. It therefore came as quite a jolt to the academic status quo when Sterling unearthed a stela at Tres Zapotes which bore an earlier date. Written in the familiar bar and dot calendrical code used by the Maya, it corresponded to 3 September 32 BC. What was shocking about this was that Tres Zapotes was not a Maya site, not in any way at all. It was entirely, exclusively, unambiguously Olmec. This suggested that the Olmecs, not the Maya, must have been the inventors of the calendar, and that the Olmecs, not the Maya, ought to be recognized as the mother culture of Central America. Despite determined opposition from gangs of furious Mayanists, the truth which Sterling's spade had unearthed at Tres Zapotes gradually came out. The Olmecs were much, much older than the Maya. They'd been a smart, civilized, technologically advanced people, and they did indeed appear to have invented the bar and dot system of calendrical notation, with the enigmatic starting date of 13 August 3114 BC, which predicted the end of the world in the epoch of AD 2012. Lying close to the calendar stela at Tres Zapotes, Sterling also unearthed a giant head. I sat in front of that head now. Dated to around 100 BC, it was approximately 6 feet high, 18 feet in circumference, and weighed over 10 tons. Like its counterpart in Santiago Tuxtla, it was unmistakably the head of an African man, wearing a close-fitting helmet with long chin straps. The lobes of the ears were pierced by plugs. The pronounced Negroid features were furrowed by deep frown lines on either side of the nose, and the entire face was concentrated forwards above thick, down-curving lips. The eyes were open and watchful, almond-shaped and cold. Beneath the curious helmet, the heavy brows appeared beetling and angry. Stirling was amazed by this discovery and reported, "The head was a head only, carved from a single massive block of basalt, and it rested on a prepared foundation of unworked slabs of stone. Cleared of the surrounding earth, it presented an awe-inspiring spectacle. Despite its great size, the workmanship is delicate and sure, the proportions perfect. Unique in its character among Aboriginal American sculptures, it is remarkable for its realistic treatment. The features are bold and amazingly negroid in character." Soon afterwards, the American archaeologist made a second unsettling discovery at Tres Zapotes: children's toys, in the form of little wheeled dogs. These cute artifacts conflicted head-on with prevailing archaeological opinion, which held that the wheel had remained undiscovered in Central America until the time of the conquest. The dogmobiles proved, at the very least, that the principle of the wheel had been known to the Olmecs, Central America's earliest civilization. And if a people as resourceful as the Olmecs had worked out the principle of the wheel, it seemed highly unlikely that they would have used it just for children's toys.